This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Trafford Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Our book today is titled Versions of Symmetry, Familiar and Non-Familiar, an extended design study workbook, Workbook 1 and 2. And our author who joins me from Ontario, Canada, is E.A. Hollywood Tuck. Liz, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
That's an unusual title, and I will mention that the word or the name Hollywood is actually your given family name.
Yes, it is.
And what is your background? Why did you decide to write this book? What motivated you to investigate the familiar and non-familiar design study area?
My background is hematology, medical technology, and a personal interest was in original design. For example, we know we have systems within the body which are connected to other systems, which are connected to other systems and chemical reactions. And my personal interest was what design feature would be common to all of those systems and also to the world around us. So that's basically the impetus there.
I'm sorry, Liz, but when you mention the word design, are you talking about actual art design, or are you talking about the scientific side or the side of design that is less visible to the human?
Yeah, the side that's less visible to ourselves, where we have adopted a way of conveying information through our drawings and models and theories. And that design feature of special interest is symmetry, the symmetry concept. My position in the book, my argument is we've misapprehended the symmetry concept, which introduces quite a substantial discussion because if we have, which I'm able to prove, have actually misapprehended the design feature, then what are the implications and what is the exact replica of such a foundational design feature?
And how does a person like myself, who is not medically trained or has no perhaps even artistic training, how would we adapt or understand your concept?
Well, I've taken an approach that if, in fact, we have misapprehended this crucial design feature, then we would need a drawing exercise, an interactive drawing exercise. So the book provides the drawing exercise that the individual can then apply and see for themselves the feature that was missed in the original drafting and inspirations of symmetry.
You have a couple of sketches in the first part of your book. One is, for describing it for my listeners, is sort of a circle split down the middle, something that we have all seen. The next design or next one that's similar to that has a small circle with a split in it inside that larger circle. What does that represent?
Yeah, the first drawing that you described was a circle with a midline. We call that, or the book is referring to that as figure one. The second figure, figure two, is the same as figure one. However, there is the second circle with a midline to the offset side of it. So the representation of figure one and figure two is symmetry, but the position of the work is that figure one, which is our popular version of symmetry, a circle with a midline, has been misapprehended, that we have conceptualized it, applied it, and disseminated that information as that being the only version of symmetry. Figure 2 provides us with a comparison system of symmetries that allow us to take a closer look at Figure 1 and discover that Figure 1 is really the beginnings of the drawing that we're after, which is Figure 2. Why would we want Figure 2? Figure 2 actually shows coordinates that present an offsetness in development. And we would be familiar with the reference to offsetness through literature. Science calls that laterality. It does turn up in sacred text or religious text as asymmetry or as disharmony. We would associate that. So there's some synonyms in here that would have to be gathered, of course, to explain and draw a relation between the two figures. So Figure 1 and Figure 2 provide a comparison system for actually detecting our misapprehension of symmetry.
You've also used or included some comments from notables such as Einstein, where he makes a statement, "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them." So there is a motivation to think outside the box. Would that be a good way to recap that?
It would be.
And when you began to write this book and do this research or have this hypothesis of 118 pages, who did you want to reach with this new idea?
Well, my field being hematology in particular, INLOT technology, makes this a reporting responsibility, really. And because it exceeds the limits of the data currently in medical science, there really isn't a pigeonhole to identify a misapprehension of symmetry as a determinant of disease, increasing risk of disease, and it being something that we would not have known about before now. So that's an important point. Under an oath of my own discipline, it is to be able to detect errors. But when the discipline stops at a certain limit of knowledge, it means that there has to be another venue. So the book became the venue.
So expanding our knowledge of not only medical things, but also the way we look at life is important.
Yes, and the symmetry concept has always been foundational. If we look at our door or window right now, we're going to look at the car and we fashion that midline into it. When we look at the door we just opened, we fashion the midline into it. Someone, myself, proposing that we have misapprehended that concept, that it is actually the beginning of a larger concept, which is perfect symmetry, and that is the offsetness in the drawing. As we proceed to finish the drawing, in other words, we started it, we got the circle, but what is the design feature beyond it? And I can just loop that back, that thought back, to laterality studies, where laterality studies is about, where is the midline? How do we detect a midline? We take it for granted in our everyday life. There's the midline, there's the door, and the draw. But what we have been detected in science and medicine is we just have asymmetry to our environment. And so those are concepts that can be, well, they're well documented, so they can be looked up, they can be evaluated. So what I did is constructed a resource center to substantiate my position on symmetry being a larger determinant of health than has been evaluated under the microscope and by medical science to this point in history.
Liz, in your studies in medical science, as has been your focus, what have you discovered that has been different or unusual in applying these precepts, these concepts?
What would be unusual or different? Well, the understanding of health and disease would then be in the individual's hands and not in the structure system alone. Being able to sit down with a piece of paper, construct a drawing exercise or complete a drawing exercise, which is on page 60 and 61 of the book, very brief and so simple, a very simple illustration. Being able to do that puts the anomaly into the hands of the individual and therefore the responsibility of health protection legislation, health protection and disease control, as opposed to the traditional lean towards environmental factors, genetic factors, lifestyle factors. We see a determinant now that is overarching those factors, bigger than those factors, and whereas those factors are the result of this larger symmetry orchestrated factor missing from our data.
Who is your target audience? Who's going to find your book not only instructive, but also something that will challenge their maybe cliche thinking?
That's a tricky one. I know for sure anybody interested in air detection professionally and perhaps as a general interest, but you know, these are sort of specialized areas. Unless someone's in crisis or has a sense of crisis or an understanding of crisis of others, it does, why would one be in the zone of error detection, redundancies in information, counterproductive patterns, the costs that become exacerbated, and the, you know, based on not detecting certain overarching and, as you say, hidden or obscure errors. So that is one, certainly one group. The general public, in that it's not easy to pick up costs from redundancies or missing information.
This is an interesting book, and certainly outside the norm. Are there other books out there that address this same subject? This one, titled Versions of Symmetry, Familiar, Non-Familiar. I have not seen this subject broached by other authors. Is this something unique to you?
Thank you for that. When you do your search, you won't find any book where the individual has personified two figures, because we are host to symmetry. If you look at me, I look at you, I can draw a midline, you can draw a midline. So we are going beyond that, the scope of readily available data, when we look at two versions of symmetry as determinants of health protection, disease control, crime detection, crime control, and it goes on. Because once you have a health detection instrument of a larger determinant of this nature, you've been touched on various mental health matters, of which we have the spectrum of disorders in our DSM manuals of our World Health Organization, and so on. So what we have is a topic that's exclusive to the Resource Center that I've constructed, and the series of publications, which I have furthered the title as The Chronicles of Two Versions of Symmetry, because this is the first of a book of many. I'm 30 years now.
Incredible.
Finishing the drawing.
Wow, 30 years. This is a book that must have taken some time. What were the challenges in getting this completed and into print?
The challenges are strictly in the reporting responsibility. That's a challenge because public disclosure of a determinant that exceeds conventional determinants isn't a small matter. So one would want to be sensitive to all players, stakeholders, and that alone is a huge challenge. Besides the fact that I worked at a bench and a microscope, I'm not an author. I am used to the brevity of information, which means I drew a drawing. And there was no pigeonhole for the drawing and the argument.
And there's more books to come.
More books to come. Therapeutic versions of two versions of symmetry, the therapeutic, non-therapeutic value of symmetry is one. Another one.
Look forward to talking with you in the future about the other books as they come on scene. This one titled Versions of Symmetry, Familiar and Non-Familiar, an extended design study workbook, workbook one of two, and our author, who has joined me from Ontario, Canada, my home country, E.A. Hollywood Tuck. Liz, thank you for joining me today. Where do we get copies of your book?
Amazon, Barnes Noble, Trafford, and the website created for this is www.good-form.org.
Thank you for joining me today and sharing your story. This is a fascinating and unique book. Thank you for sharing your background story about it. And for Indie Book Publishing Trafford Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Dix of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear these latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
This is Indie Book Publishing, brought to you by Balboa Press. My name is Brian Houston. Today we are going to talk about a book that is centered around the topic of bullying. And it deals with the person who is bullied. It deals with the impact that bullying has on a person. It also deals with people who are involved in the bullying in a way of trying to help a person who's been bullied. So there are a lot of entanglements here. And with us to talk about his book, Walk to Hope, published by Balboa Press, is the author of the book from his home in Sydney, Australia, John Golder. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well, Brian, and yourself?
Doing very well. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about Walk to Hope. First of all, I'd like to ask you a little bit about yourself.
So I was born 68 years ago. I came to Australia from England when I was very young, and spent a wide variety of roles in my life, but the last 25 I've been working for an international bank, and I retired about 4 years ago, and one of the ambitions was to finally write the book that I've always wanted to write. Life has had its ups and downs, its challenges. But part of my life has been a very strong Christian walk all my life, and that has an influence on the book. It didn't stop me being bullied. It didn't stop some of the troubles and trials, but it's all come together to give me the life that I've currently got, which is married with a wonderful wife, two great daughters, four wonderful grandchildren, and a very fulfilling life.
Congratulations on having such a wonderful family. It sounds great. How long have you thought about writing that book before it finally came to fruition?
As a teenager, I wanted to write. I mean, my history teacher at school would set an essay, and I would never write less than 50 pages, particularly when we got to American history. I found out later he only ever read the first and the last page and then gave me the same mark for 2 years. But it's always been there, but I've never been able to do it. But when I retired, I said, yes, I want to write. And we had a friend who was trying to persuade me to write a book on managing people and dealing with people based on my working experience. And I couldn't do it. So one day she just challenged me to write the book. And I said, I can't, I've given up. Hopeless. And she said, John, I can solve all your problems. She said, I own a publishing company. I'm a book editor. You're going to write a book. And she set me a challenge to start. She got me to write some bits and pieces. Said, you can tell a story. I want you to write a book. Now, all you need is a story. So I was sitting in the front row of the Sydney Opera House watching a concert, and suddenly I had a short story in my head. It was 4.5 pages. 2 years later, it's 430-odd pages, and it dealt with things that I never planned to write about, but it's a fiction story that encompasses all of the things that mattered to me in terms of dealing with the bullying, standing up for people, and then putting into practice those things that can turn a life around. Because one of my friends is very involved with working with children in schools to give them hope where they've got no hope, to give them a vision and a dream. And seeing kids who are thinking of suicide turn around and say, hey, I don't have to believe what people have been telling me all my life, that I'm dumb, that I'm hopeless, that I'm nothing. I can go and do something. So this story sort of evolved out of a situation where a young guy steps in to help a girl threatened physically, who's been bullied, who is really down and depressed. She's telling God that he doesn't care and he doesn't exist and whatever. And he steps in to help her. But stepping in to help her is a case of, what do I do? Because he's a violinist. If he gets into a fight, his whole future's gone. But he chooses to step in and help somebody that's helpless, somebody that's lost and down, even at the risk of a personal cost. And I did say you'd have trouble stopping me talking.
Oh, this is great. Yeah, you're outstanding. It's a fabulous description of the book. I want to know why you decided to write this as a fiction novel, when obviously these are very real feelings and experiences that you dealt with.
I didn't realize how deeply I felt about some of these things until after I'd finished the book. But I'm a storyteller. And I found that I could express, I always have, when I'm working with guys in church or mentoring groups or anything else, I've always found that somewhere a story pops into my mind that emphasizes or illustrates the point that I'm trying to make. And that tends to leave people with something to latch onto, not just facts and figures or whatever, but people relate to the stories. Our older history is always stories. We tell stories. And I just found it easier to put this in a storybook format. But as my 12-year-old granddaughter read the first draft, the first 50 pages, and told me my chapters were too long and she didn't like my choice of spelling for some words, and so I had to go back and start again. Right through to a fact where a friend of ours came home on 5 weeks' leave to stay with us, and he wound up doing the final proofreading on the book, and he kept saying, oh, never realised that before. So even for him, there were things in the story that the way the story was, that spoke to him about relationships and people and dealing with situations, and he got a lot out of it. So I figured, okay, I'd achieve what I wanted. But the issue is that I was bullied as a child at school, being a somewhat overweight, tall for my age, but not really an assertive person. I didn't know how to stand up for myself at school. I had teachers that preferred to use the cane rather than teach. I suffered from a mild dyslexia, which didn't help with spelling in primary school. I had a high school teacher that specialised in humiliating me because he felt he could get more out of me that way, and he probably did. And then I went to military college, where again I suffered the 12 months of bastardisation that sort of really pushed me down, and it took me a number of years to build up through to the point where out of that I had confidence in myself. And through church, through my experience with Christ, I've come to realize that I am body, soul and spirit, and I need to reflect that in who I am. And as a consequence, the story is about these young people coming to understand that if they've got a dream for their life, it's got to be one that covers them body, soul and spirit. And it can't just be about the physical. It can't just be about the emotions and the intellectual side of things. It's got to have a spiritual content. Otherwise, it ultimately is meaningless.
What was the turning point? What happened that got you turned around, that helped you to overcome this low self-esteem, this lack of confidence that marked this period in your life?
I'd always had a knowledge of who Jesus was. My mother taught me to pray when she was very small. But by the time I was about 25, married with two little girls, we joined a new church simply because the girls next door wanted to take my three-year-old daughter to Sunday school, so we figured we'd better go find out what this church was all about. And we joined the church. 4 weeks later, I was teaching Sunday school. But we started a Bible study, and we spent 9 months with the pastor and 14 others, looking at the book of 1 Corinthians. And at the end of that study, 14 of us, me included, said to the Lord in prayer, "Lord, if there's something missing from our life, we want it." And within a period of 4 days, all 14 of us were filled with the Holy Spirit. And it started a new journey because there was something in us now that didn't make us better Christians, but it gave us an inner peace and inner power and inner sense of God's presence that has been with us ever since. And that was the start of the upward journey for me, because it flowed through into my working life, where I saw God in my workplace in many ways. It was helped me in dealing with people. It's given me a compassion for people, a heart for people, and it's all flowed into what is a fictional story, but it's I like to think that it's got a lot of truth in it, and that's the reason for the title. Is that at the start of the book, the young lady, Wendy, has reached a point where she's got no hope. She's actually walking home to commit suicide, and she's carrying her school books so that her mother won't have to go to school on the Monday to pick up the books. Her home life is fractured. The parents aren't bad. They're just disconnected because they're busy saving the rest of the world. And she's attacked by bullies physically. And it's at that moment of no hope where she tells God that he's useless. If all he can do is scare a bunch of birds to fly out of a tree, and she's praying, he doesn't care about her. And by the end of the book, she can stand up and say to a group of young people, "I have a hope that is not weak, it's not wishy-washy, it is founded on a solid rock. And I now have a career as a music writer. My songs are being recorded around the world. And here is what God has done for me. And I walk in a hope that is strong." So that's the title for the book. It's actually the idea behind the cover is that two of them look at a rising sun and the off into the distance, because they're looking to the future.
Now, obviously, it seems that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that you relate most to Wendy in this book. Is there a Tom in your life that came alongside you to help you?
Well, I suppose that my Tom was my wife, who totally believed in me, even at my very lowest, and stood by me, encouraged me, lifted me up. There were a couple of pastors, close friends, who over the years have been very strong people. I mean, and encouraged me in many ways. But my wife has been the rock. In that sense, I didn't realize how autobiographical it was in some ways. And that was an interesting part of the story, of the journey. But it's a sense of saying to anybody, no matter what your age, and it's the idea of the story, it might be Seth with Wendy, and Tom is the same age, again searching for what he wants to do with his life. Does he really want to be and do the work and make the effort to become a concert violinist, and looking at the choices he's got to make, and how he and Wendy join forces, how even his faith is increased as he stands to support Wendy as she learns and grows, and they work together on their future, because it becomes their future together.
You've answered this.
Yeah, there were many people that came into my life.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. You've answered this question to some degree. I guess when it's all said and done, when someone has read this book, when they finished it, put it down, had a chance to reflect on it, what is it that you want them to feel, think, know about from the book?
I think the answer to that is I want them to feel good. I want them to feel that no matter how hopeless the situation they're in or they've been through is, that there is a future. It offers unlimited possibilities, unlimited potential, provided they make the right choices today. And it's the choices they make today, not the choices they made in the past. It's the vision and the dreams they have for the future that they're prepared to work for that will make them who they become and make their life full, complete, that will give them hope. The past, you can deal with it one way or another. No matter what you've done, no matter what mistakes you've made, that's the past. It's a matter of choosing to move forward and to make the right choices.
Fantastic. Where can people find the book? The title of it, again, is Walk to Hope. It's by Balboa Press. John Golder is the author. Where can people get this book?
You can buy it online from Balboa, from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the Book Depository. You can also get it online through Amazon and through Balboa and Balboa Press Australia. So it's pretty much there. If you do a search for Walk to Hope, it probably comes up on about page 4 of Google at the moment, but we're hoping to change that, believing to change that. So, yeah, it's available online. I don't know that it's necessarily in bookstores at this point, but we're working on that as well.
Very good. Any social media platforms that you would like to promote or any websites?
It's in the early days, but we do have a walktohope.com. Website, which is it's in its early days. Again, I'm going to start blogging shortly, but it's still a work in progress. So it's very early in my
very good
journey.
Well, John, it was a pleasure to visit with you today. Thank you very much for being willing to share your story, not only with me but obviously with the people through your book, Walk to Hope. We wish you the best of luck, and we hope that you. Have great success with this book, Walk to Hope.
Thank you, Brian.
John Golder, the author of Walk to Hope. Again, it's published by Balboa Press. My name is Brian Houston. This is Indie Book Publishing, brought to you by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The First Candle, and the author is Eric Swanson, and Eric joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Trafford Publishing. Hello, Eric.
Hello. How are you, Steve?
Great to have you with us, and you're going to take us on quite a journey here, in many ways a spiritual journey of good versus evil, especially we see that today in the news. But you're going to talk about this Martin Longbow, this content village minstrel that really doesn't understand this dark world, this evil world, because this is an epic fantasy, but along with that, a thriller, a mystery, even showing spiritual terror, or along with some even touches of humor. I mean, you've thrown it all in here, but this main character is going to be taken on quite a journey against the forces of evil. And you will learn more about all of those characters from you and the plot. But this comes out of a very scientific mind, if you will, because you're a scientist.
Yes, I am. I'm a molecular biologist.
A molecular biologist.
Now, so I move genes around, Steve.
You move, and now you've moved around. You've taken what you see in the world, I guess. You've taken what you see in the world today, and you've turned it into this, you know, it is a fantasy, but good versus evil is everywhere.
It sure is. And there's different groups. Some people have embraced the evil side, as we know, and as we have chatted. It's unbelievable that human beings would behave that way, and so you know that there's something that's not part of humanity behind the acts that these people are doing. And then there's many other groups through the book. Some of them are confused; they don't know the spiritual journey. Some of them are savage, but they're not either good or bad. They are savage, but they're just a little lost. And then there's groups like the insiders, which are a little bit like the U.S. in becoming a bit insular. They like to keep what they have in their fortified compounds and keep it to themselves. But the main protagonists are the mutants, which are a group of disfigured humans in the post-apocalypse. They, as I said, are extremely savage, but they are not necessarily evil. They have to survive in a very, very harsh world. And then you have the Sumbas, which are a ritualistic sect, not so much different, I guess, than ISIL. Very savage, very evil, and controlled. And then you have groups like Martin Longbow and his colleagues who go on a journey for a group of brothers, which are a little bit of a mystery here. And we can talk about that a little more.
So Martin Longbow and his friends are going to go up against an ageless dark demon prince. Now tell us about Agars, or is it Agars?
There's Agares.
Agares
is the name in demonology, which is, he controls about a third of the demons in hell. So like what we'd see over the Middle East now, he's a prince, a very powerful evil prince. And he controls a lot of the humans to carry on some of the acts that they do. Opposing him is basically the brothers, and they're basically a gentle sect. So they don't believe in violence. They believe basically in prayer and in spiritual forces. And if Agares has one thing he fears, it's that. He doesn't fear the bloody battles and whatnot. He's quite at home with that kind of evil, but he is disturbed by people who put up, and so he wants to crush the brothers. And Martin goes, finds himself at one of their monasteries, trapped basically, because he's chased by some of the forces that Agares controls, and they're these dark forces are, I guess, chase him up to the monastery where he meets the brothers, and the brothers are trapped there because their spirits are very easily identified by Agares and his minions. They can identify them. In fact, their sole purpose is to hunt them down. But because Martin is unaware of what's going on, he doesn't emit any kind of aura that the enemy can determine. So the brothers are forced to use him to take their message out of the monastery and send him on this quest.
Self-control is one of the themes of power in your book.
Yes. I think if I was to give you the two... in demonology, again, we have the seven deadly sins, right? We have greed and avarice and envy, and all of those are self-indulgent gluttony, self-indulgent vices. Contrary to that, we have goodness, kindness, and self-control, etc. So those are the two opposites in good and evil. And I think there's a huge battle, and it's similar to what we do. We go on and have mighty battles physically and try to defend ourselves. But war is basically an ugly thing. It's very hard to keep it in any way clean. And so I guess the comments I'm making that here in this book is that there has to be other ways that we can fight. And again, the book highlights that Agares is really fearful of prayer.
Martin Longbow, he is the hero, this village minstrel. Tell us about him. Give us a little bit more background on him.
Well, he's basically a lost soul. He's, I would say he's on the other side at the beginning of the book. He sort of likes pretty self-indulgent. He likes the fact that he has a pretty good life. The minstrels provide a little bit of solace to a very dark world. And Martin is a member of that group, and they live up in a very rare pristine mountain valley called Nooncrest, and he's pretty happy to stay out of the way of or not get involved. But unfortunately for him, that is no longer possible because the enemy comes to him, and he must gather allies. And I'd like to say that Martin is not a typical hero. He's not. There is part of his troop which is they are skilled in arms. There are others which are skilled in trapping and wood lore. Martin is basically on a quest to find what is the true answer to fighting, and it takes him along. It takes him a long journey.
Well, he has to, I guess, he is kind of forced into this because of what happens to his best friend.
Yes, and that's a pretty savage, and it shows the forces and how his friend, again, is very strong. He won all the strongman competition in Nooncrest, and he's... Martin's always thought of him as a powerful individual. Well, he is taken down very crudely by the forces, Sumba forces, which are working on Agares and Agos' instructions to eliminate these brothers. And as part of that, they're going to also eliminate the minstrel groups. So the minstrel groups will go to different places. They'll go to Sumba encampments, Agartha, and a few other places, and Shimmerthon, and they'll also go and see some insider ones. They'll do a lot of traveling. They'll go across the sea, and they'll find another group called the Tuljin Knights. And they, too, have been seeking a defense against Agares. They have both. They have the knights are extremely well-skilled in battle, but they're also well-skilled in the spiritual realm. So they actually are a force to be reckoned with. And Martin goes to find them.
And ultimately, they, in their... best and I guess strongest, deepest humility, they need to enlist the aid of the mighty cherubim and seraphim.
And that ultimately, I guess, is true. Basically, we understand it, man decided that God was not going to be in charge, and he decided he'd like to be in charge. So man is basically in charge of the earth right now, and his solace is that he can pray and God can answer prayers, and God can send, the cherubim and the seraphim, which are powerful angels to do battle for them. But this would require a great deal of prayer and humility to get them to come down.
So in many ways, deep in your own heart, you see the future of this world with all the evil and all the brutality that we're witnessing in the news right now. Of the power is there as we humble ourselves and turn to God?
You know, that's correct. And I have to say I'm of two minds. I want to stand so firm, like all of us do, against these groups. And it's a very difficult choice not to become like them. And once the spiritual evil starts to infest us, we start to do the same. I think you'll notice that many factions are now coming. The terrorist groups are coming, both in the Islamic and also on the other side. This evil is just fermenting and stirring it up. And there are many people who are completely lost as to how to respond to that. Some believe they should respond by going to war, and that's why you see so many people enlisted by these groups. They think that's the answer, and it's obviously not. It's part of the evil that's there. And I'd like to think, Steve, that it's this is not it. ISIL is not it. I think that there's going to be more, and I'm looking forward to doing another book on the blood moons. And we're not going to have four blood moons. We have them this year, four blood moons. That's when the sun, then the earth, and then the moon. And when the sun shines through the earth's atmosphere, it absorbs blues, and it radiates reds. So the moon can take on a bloody hue. And we know from scriptures that this is a sign. The moon will turn to blood. And so I believe next year, the year after that, there's going to be some remarkable things happen. And I think and I'm very worried about the evil. And I think the gentleness that I see in some of the Islamic groups, the Christian groups, the Jewish groups, there's not very much of that. There's a lot of people who are on the militant side, but there is goodness, and we have to keep on looking to that to prevent this evil from dominating in our world.
You have a movie, a 60-second movie of your book on YouTube.
Yes, I do. And I'm very pleased with it, with the group that I worked with did a really good job, and I congratulate them. It's a very good way to find basically the story and synopsis in 60 seconds. It's and it tells about the journey. Again, Martin Lobo's basically got to find and join the sword of the spirit rather than the sword. And to find out that sword of the spirit is actually what this evil doesn't enjoy.
So everyone, you can go to YouTube, put in the first candle, and it will come up, and very well done.
Yeah, www.thefirstcandle.com, and if that doesn't help you, then just put Eric beside it, and that will come up. And I was just came back from Toronto for a book fest in Toronto, which was a great deal of fun. We had about 150,000 people there in Queen's Park in Toronto, and that was it was great to see all the authors from many different genres.
Certainly, certainly. Well, Eric, we appreciate you being with us on this show, talking about The First Candle. Eric Swanson, tell us, what's the best way to get your book?
The best way is probably Amazon.ca in Canada and Amazon.com in the U.S.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Eric, on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you very much, Steve, and we'll see you later.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Trafford Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.